Blog Talk Radio.
The HD View.
Happy Tuesday, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the Health HD, the HD View. This is your host, Melissa Biliardi. Our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 or 877-497-4103. When you call in, press 1. We'll key you into the show. Please tell all your colleagues, friends, and family about Help for HD Radio and click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. Thank you, 82,000 listeners, for tuning in. Tonight, we get to welcome back our dear friend Jimmy Pillard back to us. It's been a year already, and he's been traveling around the U.S. speaking with families who are touched by HD. Some of the places he's been are Milwaukee, Syracuse, Connecticut, Western Massachusetts, Long Island, San Antonio, Louisiana, White Plains, Sioux Falls, Raleigh, Allentown, Louisville, Newark, Lawton. My goodness. Welcome back, Jimmy. How are you?
I'm good, and thanks for having me back. And thanks to everybody who's going to hear this, because one of the most important things you can do on any given day is to affiliate with others like you guys at Help for HD, and your affiliates facilitate. I can't think of anything more important collectively for us to do something about Huntington's disease. So thanks for having me back. I'm glad to be part of it.
You've been a very busy person. How many days on the road are you during the year? My goodness.
We're always looking for more opportunities, but I have been pretty busy, and I really have a gift of having the CHDI Foundation fund my work to go around and talk to families and meet them and help out in a number of ways. So that's a gift for me, because I get to meet people all over the United States, families who are directly touched by Huntington's disease, including the folks with HD themselves. So it's pretty much in the spring and fall, it's every weekend other than holidays, and slows down obviously in the dead of winter and in the prime of summer. But other than that, almost every weekend I'm talking to a support group or an education day or some other function that folks have put together, including if families are having some kind of family function and want somebody to speak about HD and some in a more practical way than, what are the symptoms of HD, for example, but how it really affects how people are going to interact with you. We do that at family events, too, cookouts and church meetings and whatever. So I'm pretty engaged most weekends in that kind of stuff, which is just wonderful for me personally. I love to do it.
That's fantastic. Now, what kind of differences are you seeing in the communities as you're traveling around? Are you seeing like clusters of families? Are you seeing a lot of relatives? I mean, how does that affect
locations? I don't. First of all, I get asked that question often, but I don't really know the answer. I wonder sometimes myself when I get to a rural place and 25 people show up and you wonder how there could be that many people. But I really don't know. It's also biased by, when you show up at the meeting, not only by the number of people, families that are touched by Huntington's disease that live there, but also at how who's ever run the meeting has been able to reach them, or their, predecessors over the years have contacted the families. So it's really hard to tell. I suspect there are, but I can't really put my finger on it,
What are some of the main things that they're concerned about? Care or, treatments, what are they asking you about?
first of all, they ask a lot. They ask both. You kind of painted the in that sentence you just asked, the question you just asked, you know, kind of the dichotomy of what can we do now for these folks and families that are facing Huntington's disease, the now, which kind of has been characterized over the decades, at least in the U.S., as kind of the care-related stuff, versus the what are we going to do about this in the longer term to do something about eradicating Huntington's disease or getting some, you know, like I say, to do something about Huntington's disease, which is a generic, you know, vernacular term, doing something about it, that encompasses the whole thing of what people say about whether it's a cure or whether it's a therapeutic or whether it's slowing the progression or whatever. I don't think there may be strategic stuff that's lost on me scientifically over those subtleties, but I think at any given moment, anybody who's facing it would take any one of those kind of things, whatever they turn out to be. So that is something that needs to be addressed now too. So you get questions like that, which can all be boiled down to when the hell are they going to do, they, meaning scientists, going to really have that aha moment and we're going to be able to have something practical and, you know, accessible now that we can take a medication for Huntington's disease. But there's also the problems, especially here in the United States, about getting care for people who have some of the more challenging manifestations of HD, particularly if they are in denial and don't want help, or if they have different kinds of psychiatric problems like delusions, hallucinations kind of stuff, or all kinds of behavioral problems. Our system has not made it easy for families or their loved ones themselves to get taken care of. So there's those kind of things, and there's not a lot, frankly, to offer, even though any system, if you will, human service system, it could be in the rural South or it could be in the remote West or it could be in the highly populous Northeast, and nobody seems to be doing much better than anybody else in terms of taking care of those people, and families often are confronted with literally nowhere to go. So you hear all those kind of stuff. And both ends, the future, the cure, the science, as well as the now care stuff, all those things are well known to every family who faces Huntington's disease. Only the questions, concerns, and worries, you know, may be unique to them. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Well, do our families out there feel like they have a voice in any of this, or are they just kind of thinking there's no hope? I mean, I hope you're delivering, that message of hope.
I think there are some people who get discouraged, clearly, as in any other human endeavor, and they're there. But, no, overall, I think people are hopeful, have hope, clearly. I mean, I think that's what keeps people going. And all you got to do is look around and see all the different kinds of things that people are doing to address this problem that their family faces, as well as the public health challenge of Huntington's disease. The number of things that people do, if we just take a minute, I've got a bunch of Post-it notes with these kind of notes here sitting on my desk as I speak to you. I mean, just think about this for a minute. What do people do? So are they discouraged or down or don't see hope? I don't think so, because among the things, you have people, you know, teaching other people yoga to deal with it. They're, you know, raising money by doing crazy stuff, dressing up like chickens and vegetables and wearing jeans to work on Friday. And I have a friend, Diana Fisher, in Iowa, and at their big community thing, they shave their heads, and some of the guys shave their chest to raise money and do it. They have pub crawls. They have all the walks, the hundreds probably bazillions of miles that people walk to raise money, including, I noticed on one of the websites the other day, the Scottish Huntington's group is currently enlisting people to do a fire walk, never mind running. I know in Pennsylvania they've got, in Western Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh, Alex Andrus and the gang out there have been doing their, I think it's a 5K or maybe a half marathon, Charlotte's Run. Charlotte was Alex's mom. And they've been doing that for 25 years. You have all the people that run the marathons literally all over the world to bring awareness to Huntington's disease. I can think of Tracy Jones in Perth in Western Australia who many years ago now drove her bike around the edge of Huntington's disease, and that guy in the UK, Chris King, who's doing like a marathon every day for a couple of months.
Yeah, we had him on the show here too,
Amazing. The people that rollerblade, I forget their names, across the United States, the people who in the UK climb Ben Nevis, one of their big mountains, and the people, then the Shana Mountain Group, and I'm sure there are others who climbed Everest, never mind to speak of Shana Mountain, rolling logs, and all the people who jump from planes or bungee jump from bridges, all in the name of doing something about Huntington's disease, and go on all these long bike rides all over Europe. Never mind the woman, Marie Nemec from Colorado, who does the thing to the HDSA convention, and the people at the lawnmower races, and the dances, and people have rode across the Atlantic. I could go on, and I'll stop there. So when you say, are people discouraged, or they don't have hope, man, they're doing a lot of stuff all over the world. So it's hard to believe, you know, that anybody that a significant amount of people aren't anything less than hopeful.
Let's talk about science. I know, you know, you're going around and you're talking about science too, right?
I'm talking about what we can do to get people to consider volunteering for science, research studies of all kinds. Because if you, which is really what I was leading up to, and I went on too long with it, if people are doing all of this stuff, there's great hope and obviously great excitement. If they're doing all of that, there is one thing, though, that I think we really need to look at closely as a community, and that is getting an adequate number of research volunteers to be available and volunteering to fund all these studies that are on board now and all the ones that are down the line. Because I think that some things, if you consider a couple of things, that we can actually expedite whatever's down the road in terms of doing something about Huntington's disease, that we can make it happen quicker. When you ask any group of people touched by Huntington's disease, when do you want a cure for Huntington's or whatever you want to call it, invariably people will immediately say yesterday, or they'll say now. But then if you wait a couple of seconds, somebody will say, how about yesterday? And I've come to think, you know, that that's a legitimate question to ask ourselves as a group. Can we make it yesterday? Well, obviously we can't make it yesterday living in the today and the now. Excuse me. But maybe by what we do today in the future, at some point we could have expedited and in effect make it be yesterday or sooner. I think about if you look to the future sometime, who knows when, the sooner the better. There will be a time when you start hearing stuff about some of these clinical trials that are going well. We'll clearly hear it in the world of social networking, and families will start, you know, saying how well their loved one's doing. And then we'll probably hear that there's a study concluding and they're crunching the data and that there's going to be an announcement. And people might, again, thinking this through and kind of trying to imagine this, people kind of jockeying to figure out what's going to happen. At that point, when we get there, as we look at it, when something's about to happen, the things that people worry about, one might guess, all the time, the nature of the things that folks worry about for their families might change quickly at that time. And it's going to be more like a lot of people with multiple sclerosis faced a decade ago. The things people worry about is how soon is it going to be available, especially for certain members, or am I going to be able to get it, or how much is it going to cost, or is Dr. So-and-so going to be able to get it at their clinic because I've been going there for a long time? Are some people going to get preference? Is it going to be based on how far you are in the disease? Who knows what it is? But at that point, I really think that we should probably try to get our heads and envision that day and then say to ourselves, could we have made it yesterday at that day in the future? And I think there are some considerations that we need to think about that that suggest maybe we could. For example, a couple of them. One is science is the nature of science is cumulative. So, you know, one discovery leads to new facts, and those facts are built in or integrated into a whole other thing, and whole disciplines, bodies of knowledge, and new things, you know, are discovered and organized and recalibrated. And as Ed Wild, I don't know if you've had him on, but he's the HD Buzz guy, and he's been at many conventions around the world that people have heard. Ed uses the analogy of science growing, and he always talks about it. A glacier is, you know, a bazillion snowflakes. But without any bunch of individual snowflakes, there's no glacier, as powerful as the glacier is. So everybody's little thing creates to this big thing. And the science, and it is a cumulative process, and it's growing in front of us. For example, and I've been in this community since 1986, so let me give you an example of how science has grown in front of us in these years. Am I talking too much, or can I go on?
No, keep going. And by the way, we have invited HD Buzz on, but they haven't come on. So if you can facilitate that, that would be awesome.
If you have a Twitter account, Badger Ed, he's a prolific Twitterer. Anyway.
Okay, good idea.
But just an example of how science grows in front of us. My first convention, national convention, or a national meeting of any kind, actually, was one of the ones in Des Moines, Iowa, many years back. And this guy, there was the obligatory Ask the Doc panel. And on the panel was Dr. Michael Keneally. Old-timers will recognize his name. He's now retired, but he is from Roscommon, Ireland, and spent his career at the University of Indiana Medical Center, where he had the HD registry. And he was very critically involved in getting the first large family up in Iowa to contribute all their blood and the search for the gene and the marker and everything. But anyway, he was on the Ask the Doc panel, and somebody asked a question of I see, very reluctantly, I might add, but the guy, you know, raised his hand in the back of the room and said, I see that there are black people with Huntington's disease and white people with Huntington's disease. Are you saying that everybody is, if we all have HD, are we all related? And Keneally said, well, what do you mean by that? And the guy said, well, you know, is Huntington's disease before the races, whatever the term is in evolution, specified or whatever. In other words, are we all brothers? And he said, yes, you are all brothers, says Keneally. And now we know a bunch of years later, but my point is in my 20 years, 23, 4 years here now we know that maybe that's not the case, that there is spontaneous mutation. Another guy moments later asked Keneally if that he didn't have a family history of Huntington's disease. How could this be? And basically, Keneally said it might be a case of non-paternity. Now, most of the people in the room, including me, had never heard the term non-paternity. So the guy said, well, what's non-paternity? And in his charming Irish brogue, Keneally said, well, I don't know how to sell you this, but maybe your daddy isn't who you think your daddy is. And,
okay, yeah, get it.
Right, and,
get it.
But that was the point is, that was the best science had to offer that guy then. Now we know, just in my 23 years, of the gray zone. We didn't know that. And now we know how there can be spontaneous mutations and how the CAG count can creep into where you're going to be affected. So just that answer from the best and brightest, you know, in my lifetime, is now archaic compared to what we have learned so quickly. So science is accumulating right before us, and there are other examples. When the big discovery that was in the New York Times, I can't remember, Nancy, I can't remember which one it was, and I apologize, but the point is that the advance was that we had discovered that there were, quote, and the word was that Nancy Wexler used was clumps of genetic material in the nucleus of the cell, and those clumps were the issue. Now we know so much more, and this is just in the last 20 years, that it's more than those clumps, and those clumps may or may not be the primary thing. There's so much more going on. So the point I'm trying to make is the science is cumulative, but it's cumulative. We can see it right in front of us if people who are better at explaining it than I can point it out. We also need to consider, as we think about can we expedite this, that all studies, all conditions, not just Huntington's disease, everything that go wrong with the human condition. All studies fail to recruit on schedule at a rate of 86%. In other words, 86% of studies, all diseases, fail to recruit on schedule. That's really mind-boggling. And the participation rate, all diseases, all human conditions, for people in medical research is about 1 or 2%. Of people who are eligible.
Wow.
It is. It's if unless you know that, it's kind of shocking the first time you hear it.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're only getting 1 or 2%, how well are Huntington's families doing? Well, it's hard to quantify, but most of the people who know this kind of stuff in our community suspect or guesstimate that HD families are participating at a rate of about 2 or 3%. Which is double, you know, the rate of everybody else. So as a community, we're doing really good.
Mm-hmm.
But as more studies come online, those gaps for where studies don't start on time are important. And they are in a real way. Most of the studies that we now know from Reed newsletters all these years have either completed not on time, or got started delayed, or had different kinds of starts than they originally anticipated. And if we could just jack up the rate of participation, maybe we could eliminate those gaps. Maybe we could, you know, when a study is funded and they start all over at trying to recruit people, those delays. Since science is cumulative, if we could get rid of those delays, that day in the future down the road, we could, in effect, looking back, say, we expedited it because we had adequate numbers of people. We didn't have to devote any time to delaying or not completing studies in such a timely way. When you look
so
at
Jimmy,
the...
So, what do you think are the obstacles there?
I don't know, and I don't know, and I got to say, as one who's not personally affected, I tread lightly because I really don't know. But I do know that whatever it is, one of the things that we can be doing, and I think as a community, I know it's a good idea because people love doing it, and that is to look at all of the people who already participated and all the ones that are participating now.
Right.
they're really heroic. And for all the things
absolutely,
we say people are wonderful about for all the stuff they do in high disease, a lot of our stuff, and I speak of what I do, it pales in comparison. It's actually not even important in compared to that these people have actually participated in doing something about it.
Right.
And it is a confidential decision, and I'm not trying to sway anybody who's who lives with it. But I am asking, as just a general community member, somewhat self-appointed, that as you make your decision, just consider this big picture. That's all. You can only do what you can only do and all of that stuff, and we respect all of that. But everybody's individual decision. What?
Well said. They're heroes, for sure.
They are. And some of them have done multiple studies. Some of them have done it now for 10-plus years. They're not the you know, I like to say this to them. When I give talks, some people might have, if anybody's listening and has been there, if they've seen me do this, it's always kind of very poignant. If I'm, as I say, I often talk about this very thing and say, if there's any, you know, participating in research is a confidential thing and it's a private thing, but many people who do it are very open about it and want to talk about it. If there are any of those people here and would like to identify yourself so we could just thank you, please do it. And usually people will do it.
Yeah.
And I like to tell those people as they stand up, you are the foundation of science. And that is not a metaphor. And I like wave my finger at them and say, you are not a metaphor, that your contributions are real.
Yeah.
And it ain't growing without your participation, no matter how many devoted, best and brightest we have working on our behalf, unless they have the players to participate in their studies, it's going nowhere.
We won't have treatments, therapies, or a cure without their help. We just won't.
Which is not, I mean, to me, not to me, that's just a statement of fact. I mean, I always think of reading any research article, right? And I always think of, so there's the title and there's the authors. Now, if you're in academic, you know, whatever, all of academe, but in biomedical research, getting your spot on, you know, the author stuff is really important to your career and you know, and who your pedigree is of your mentors and all that. It's really important, those things. And then you get down below the list, say, you got the title, you got the authors, and then you got the abstract or the summary, and then after that you get down into the meat of the thing, and the procedural stuff will say things like, you know, we did the University of Kansas City's rating scale on 25 people, motor subtest, or we examined the postmortem brains donated by people, or we did, you know, reviewed this test, or we gave PET scans or MRIs to X amount of people. Those people, given the nature of science and studies, are nameless, but without them in there, there would be no abstract, no authors, no damn title. It really is, from our point of view, the most important part of that study. And it's a selfless thing for the greater good that all the other wonderful stuff that for as far as we've come, for all these people that are working on it literally at any moment somewhere around the world, without our players saying, I will, whether they do it. And when we recognize them, they like to tell their stories. I'm doing it for my kids. I'm doing it for my niece. I'm doing it for my husband, you know, whatever. Without them, end of discussion.
Right. That is
so
anyway, true, you know.
Yeah. So I think we can make it. I think there's more to it when somebody kind of sarcastically or humorously will say, you know, when you ask when you want to cure Huntington's disease, and somebody says, what's wrong with yesterday? Maybe we can make it, in a sense, yesterday, someday in the future by what we do now. And we just got to get everybody not to, you know, coerce them or influence them in their personal decision, but at least to consider the importance that their individual decision also makes on the greater community.
Right. Hey, we have a question or comment.
Mm-hmm.
Dave Hodgson. Hi, Dave. He says, Jimmy, go Blackhawks. He says, but I digress. How well do the HD ambassadors do toward gaining participants in the many clinical drug trials going on?
That's a good question. I don't know. It's funny that he asked that question because I wonder myself, and I wonder for all, I mean, whether I'm talking about care and trying to get people to understand some of the interactions about, you know, how people process information, I can give a good talk and I can entertain people while I'm doing it, et cetera, et cetera. But when I'm leaving at the end of the day or when I'm after a week, I wonder, did I really get anybody to change anything a week after they've seen my talk that's going to change the life or the experience of funny disease for somebody who's living it? Similarly, I wonder if for all of the talks we do about the importance of this, we're really changing the face of it and we're getting more people to reconsider and maybe actually getting more volunteers. I don't know the answer, Dave. I'd love to know. And if we knew that, I think it would allow us to, like any other data that we would have, to alter the change of course, alter our course, do what works, do more of what's working and less of what's not working, and how to make a more compelling, quick layout of what needs to be considered for any one person. So I wish we knew the answer to that, but I don't. Maybe somebody else does, but I don't know if that's available. If it is, I'd love to see it, and I don't know about it.
Yeah, we've had a couple of comments in the chat room. I don't know if it's okay for me to say her name, but you know, his name, whoever. But this person says, that was such a great point, participating in the various studies, projects, et cetera. And they say, I've done it in the past, as have many of my family members. You guys are heroes, that's for sure. That's what I'm saying. It is fairly harmless, really, they say. And just think what the results could mean, right?
Right.
Thank you for your comments.
Right. It is.
Yeah.
I mean, my silence to that comment is obviously my consent. And
yeah, for sure.
There's thousands of them. You know, it's like to go with my brother Dave, there's actually that's a hockey analogy, being from Boston. But, you know, I'm sure that any of the Stanley Cup champion Blackhawks players, the old saying is none of them will ever buy a drink in Chicago again because there'll be a fan to pick up the tab, you know?
Yeah.
I always say somebody who participates in Honey Z's research should never pay for a drink at a Honey Z's meeting hotel, hotel, you know, wherever a meeting is or any function. We should treat them with the same appreciation, the same notoriety as we would, you know, a Chicago Blackhawk or a Boston Bruin when they won the Stanley Cup. You know, we need to, as a community, I think, recognize these people. And it's hard to do because they're humble, they're self-effacing. They just, unless you ask them, you know, they don't wear uniforms. They're just doing their thing. And it's hard to spot them unless you ask. And somehow we should be making sure that we express our gratitude as often
honor
as we can.
Honor them, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, honor them. That's right.
Do we have a comment from someone? I don't know. James, did you get a comment from somebody? We have lost James. Oh, there he is.
No, I'm here.
Oh, here's some.
Once
we've
again,
got
I'm not
some more
sure whether people
here.
Have given permission for their name.
Okay. Okay. Let me look into this chat room here. Dave Hodgson's making more comments. Listens closely. He says, he's saying, LOL, too funny. Deb Madden. Okay, Deb, hi. My daughter donated her brain to science. That is noble. Okay, hold on. My chat room is going crazy here. That is noble of her at such a young age. However, as a mom, how do you digest this? She's my child. Yeah, that's a comment. Another person says, we also did PET scans, glowing in the dark from drinking that liquid. And then, good one. She made another comment. Let me see if I can find it. She says, way back in the early 70s, we did things like let them swab your mouth for saliva samples and cut a piece of your hair for studies. I don't know if they're still doing that.
That she pointed that out. That's perfect.
Yeah. She also says, Deb, thankfully they haven't figured out a way to take a brain while the person is still alive.
Right, exactly.
So, yeah,
exactly.
Although they might do that. I don't know. Who knows?
There was a guy here in Boston who used to, when you talk about the PET scan, the MRIs, and all that stuff, to take an MRI is not as loud as it doesn't seem to be anyway, as it used to in the early days when a lot of people, like evidently this woman, would volunteer. And I remember there was a guy who used to go to Dr. Walter Koroshet's lab at Mass General way back when, and his name was Mike. He's since passed on, but Mike used to say, when people say, so what's it like being an MRI? And he used to take, he would take a metal wastebasket next to like somebody's desk and pull out the liner with the garbage and put it over his head and just start pounding on it and say, it's like this.
Yes,
it's just, it's not scary. It's just loud.
Oh, I think
all those things like that woman is pointing out that people have done.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can chuckle about it, recalling it, but it is exactly what we're saying. It's a noble thing for the greater good that is absolutely both vital to the long-term problem and urgent, as in now, at the same time, both vital and urgent simultaneously.
Hey, Jimmy, you put something in your outline to me that I kind of wanted you to talk about. You talked about the urgencies of care and cure coexist and that they don't compete. What did you mean by that?
What I meant by that is, and I'm just kind of probably being a bad summarizer of what I've learned from a lot of other people over the years. And, I mean, the kind of, you know, at least in the United States, and some degree around the world, but I think it's heightened in the United States, is that all of our stuff is always kind of broken into either deal with the care issues, the here and now of what we face this day ahead of us, or what do we do long-term, you know, what do we do upriver to prevent this problem so that another family, another generation, another family member, or a whole other generation, you know, is affected, and that's the cure stuff, the science. And that I know for money and stuff over years, that's been, you know, kind of contentious. You have the care people and the cure people, and they think a lot, allocate your money here, you allocate whatever. And, I mean, I don't want to get into that as a person. The bottom line is, to me, that I've kind of watched this over the years, and I know in the United States, the lay advocacy movement, I think it's kind of hindered our smooth development of 40-plus years. But the point is, we got to deal with today, and we got to deal with our bigger problem for future generations, given the nature of this, And they, so we got to do both at the same time. Mm-hmm. And we, that's no choice. I mean, that's one of the other horrors of Huntington's disease. It affects you today, and it's going to affect you tomorrow. It's going to affect people who aren't you, who are yours down the road. That's just yet another horrible part of HD. So you got to do both at the same time. They coexist. So, yes, we got to deal with all the stuff about tomorrow and all of the problems and challenges that bringing care, or if you have HD, living with it, bring. But also, we got to, you know, play the long game, too. They coexist, this is all I'm saying. And you got to do both at the same time. You have no choice. Even if we're going to cure Huntington's disease or whatever, we're still going to wake up tomorrow and the urgencies are going to be there. So just the nature of the problem, we got to do both. They coexist. I don't think one should, you know, push the other out, and people should get hung up on, you know, one or the other. They're both there. You can decide where to spend your money or where you want to allocate your staff or whatever. But as activists and advocates, we got to realize both are there at the same time. I don't know if that's what you meant, because I don't remember writing it. Totally. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I've got some more comments for you, Dave. Let me see if I can get this here. Where did it go? My chat room's going nuts here. Sorry about that. Sorry for the delay, guys. I'm just trying to go through the chat room. I think James is having to leave us here. So Dave says, we can do all the advertising in the world, spend all the money in the world marketing HD, but it's a fact that word of mouth, us people, will get 2 times as much good than any ad campaign. That's true, right? Oh, my goodness. Dolphin says, CAT scan used to sound like when the washing machine goes off tilt.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, tilt.
Right.
Says, yeah.
Only you can't. Okay. Oh, only you can't get up and level it. You just got to stay in the damn thing.
Get some really good earplugs for your HD person. Sure. Judy Robinson says, hi, Judy. She says, agree with Dave. It's the face-to-face word of mouth from a trusted advocate that encourages others to sign up for a study trial. Yeah, that's for sure. And then Dave says, and only 7% of word of mouth advocacy is done online, according to the experts.
That's interesting.
Not online. I don't know. Good
comment. I mean, Judy and Dave are senior partners, not because they're seniors, but just they've been in this community and active for a long time. They're age peers of mine, so I'm serious. But
I'm
think
a senior too.
There you go. But
yeah.
I think that's true. When I went through that whole list of things that people do, whether they're jumping out of airplanes, walking through fire, if we could just get everybody to just on one day stop what they're doing, which is all worthwhile, and if it's what they want to contribute, that's great, because nobody's done it before and it wasn't around, you know, 10 years ago. But if we could just take a chunk of that energy of one day and put everybody on this to make sure that everybody eligible considers whether or not they want to or can or want to, and then how everybody else, because everybody has a different role to play, can support them or can drive them to meetings or, you know, can take care of their kids or can, if you have are excluded for whatever criteria, you can say, go for it, Charlie, because I was in, you know, I was in care to HD, or what, name the study, PREDICT. I did PREDICT for so many years. You know, now you do it, man. You know, just if we could just get everybody word of mouth, as Judy and Dave say, just to talk to everybody in the community. That's why when I got on today, I said, because I open almost all my talks by the same thing, being here together is probably the most important thing we can do. It's basic community organizing stuff that needs to be done. And as much as we like social media, there's nothing like people interfacing, and also putting a bite on people to say, I know you're busy, and we're not trying to sway your decision, but we just want you to consider this. Can you give me 5 minutes? Oh, you know, whatever. But, yeah, I agree. It's still getting out there and talking to people and showing them, this, I think, anyway, this big picture. Because, I was slow to learn this. I was basically listening to so many scientists present their stuff and then kind of mention that, you know, they were still recruiting people. And after a while, it dawned on me, you know, man, there's a whole lot of subjects that are still needed. Got to do something about that.
Yep. Okay, more comments. Let's see. Oh, do most of us feel like HD is still in the closet? That was a question.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. I think it is. I think there are some families that don't want to talk about it. They don't want to face it. It's too scary. And I understand that, but we have to face the monster, you know? If we're going to defeat him, we got to face him.
Right.
Let's see. I'm older than Judy, says Dave. Jimmy, respect your elders, damn it.
That's right. I think technically he's right.
Oh, goodness. Dave said, Dolphin, I did in the 80s and 90s, but not anymore. Oh, I don't know that merit. Dolphin says, thank you to the hosties for allowing the chat portion of this to be available, too.
Yeah, well.
You're welcome. It's supposed to be so rare, but I moved across country, and first time I went to the market, I saw a guy in the parking lot who had HD. That was delight, she says. I don't know. But good comments, you guys, and it's really nice to have this interaction in the chat room.
You know, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, when I think of Dave and Judy and being at this for a while and thinking back to some old online stuff and chats with other people, and there's others, too, who've been at this a long time that, you know, I am glad I've come to know over the years. But there always used to be, you would often hear people talk about whether any given study was promising. And people would say, well, I'm going to wait for a more promising study or whatever. That is now the way it's worked out. That's not the way it goes. And that laying back, if you are going to do it. Now, if you choose not to do it, that's, you know, your prerogative, and we respect that, and we love you, and maybe there's some other way you can help if you want. But laying back and strategically doing it is only going to contribute to those delays. And now we have studies worldwide like Registry and Predict and Cohort, all these observational studies that will be folded in, I think is the term they use, into Enroll. And one of the things about that that's most exciting is it'll be a worldwide, literally worldwide, including the 10,000, I think. They broke 10,000 recently in the registry study in Europe. And all of the folks in the U.S., I just embarrassed as an American. I don't know the numbers. Shame on me to my colleagues. And to have them all enrolled into one big study in the next couple of years. But the study will, like the other ones that it has folded into it, people will go every year. It's a study for everybody. If you are a spouse or whatever, you can volunteer as a control. Once a year, you go and, you know, do your testing and stuff. You don't have to genetically test, but you do have to give blood. But one of the other key things for me of Enroll is that it serves as a platform where people will be followed, and it'll make easier recruiting people. And on the drawing boards, it will eliminate all of these kind of delays, ideally, but it will at least certainly, you know, it's people in their design addressing these kind of issues that will allow us to, you know, make it yesterday, if you will, or expedite it.
Right. My philosophy is do it now. Don't wait. Do it now, you know.
Right.
Because
right.
Tomorrow's too late. We got to do it now.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, again, I'm not personally affected, but I know that everybody who is, it's another day of what this damn thing puts in front of you, whether it's mm-hmm. going to work or just managing your home or living with it or trying to tie your shoes. I mean, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Kath, nice to meet you. Thanks for making the comments. And it's really fun to have some interaction here. Jimmy, you've really brought up some really good points. And, you know, I've heard people say, well, I'm just going to wait till something, you know, promising comes out. Well, if we just wait and wait and wait and don't participate, then things are just not going to progress, I don't think, for us.
I mean, I remember
right?
people saying that online in chat rooms
mm-hmm.
and stuff. And it was a different time. There wasn't as much going on. The science, like we said, hadn't accumulated. It was in the days of non-paternity, not the gray zone or spontaneous mutation. Things have changed so much, and there's so much happening simultaneously that we need our folks to be those who are going to choose to do it, to be ready and willing. I mean, somebody gave me the analogy a long time ago that you can think of it as a basketball game in a big, you know, 15,000 arena, seat arena. And the coach has his 11 players to pick from on his team, but all of a sudden there's some situation that he can't manage, and he's got to pick a guy in the third balcony who's an attendee, he's just there watching the game, up in the nosebleed section. He's the only guy who really qualifies for this, and we're going to put him in the game suddenly. And the guy that was the point that this actually was a woman was trying to make, she said, you don't know. I mean, we got to be ready to go into the game at any time, even if we're spectators, even if
right,
we
right.
don't look like we're qualified today, the next go-round, we might be essential. We might be the linchpin to, you know, being qualified. And we all got to be ready. And I think that's what these studies that are being folded into Enroll have achieved to a degree already, and hopefully Enroll, since it gives a worldwide platform, which is really exciting in many, many ways. I mean, you call your thing Help for HD International, that notion of everybody in the world on something. It's,
yep.
it's really, you know, gratifying.
It's global. It's a global effort, right?
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway.
Good stuff. There was something else I was going to ask you. Now I can't remember what it was. Darn it. Oh, I know what I was going to ask you. Okay, with CHDI is working on so many new potential trials. Do you foresee a problem with competing trials, people, not enough people to go around or anything like that?
I defer to people who would know that better than I. I think as just
I know that's a
somebody.
Tough question.
Yeah, well, I don't know is the answer, and I'm certainly not mm-hmm. qualified to answer it. However, let me just say, in my total kind of simple laypersonness, there are a limited number of people that we have available. They're really a valuable commodity, and hopefully, you know, somehow it's coordinated so that is not a problem. And I'm sure there are some people thinking about it already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think that's a little bit over my head.
Doing, I think what you're doing and others are doing, going around to, you know, local community support groups, that kind of thing, is really going to help. you know, spread the word, you know, what we're doing online and with the Blog Talk Show and, you know, all the stuff that we, I mean, you know, hopefully we're going to capture the majority of the audience out there that, you know, we need to. And, you know, there's many ways to get the word out. And if we can all work on it together,
right,
I think, you know, we'll be able to make an impact. So.
Right. And
yeah,
the nice thing about being online is the casual person who wants to maintain their anonymity as they stick their toe in the water of information can do it, you know. And without it, we wouldn't have been able to get those people.
Mm-hmm.
Or have the opportunity to get them anyway.
Well, thank you so much, Jimmy, for coming on and talking
to us
about all the stuff you're doing. Now, what's this year look like for you? What are you doing this year?
What am I doing this year?
Do you have more plans to keep, you know, going
out
into the world?
Tallahassee. Greg Suter is going to have me at the Hereditary Neurologic Center support groups. St. Louis, Cleveland I'm doing, Waukesha, Wisconsin again. Excuse me, the folks in Boise, Idaho, going to do a long-term care conference and a support group up there. At Fargo, North Dakota in October. And a bunch of support groups in the meantime. If anybody needs a speaker, just shoot me an email, jjpollard@comcast.net. It's real easy. We're easy to work with. And, again, thanks to CHDI for supporting me personally and letting me a small part of their team.
Good stuff. Let me know, put your email into the chat room, if that's okay with you, jjpollard@comcast.net, right?
Yep. Do I have one more minute?
Okay.
I could say one more thing?
Yes,
and that'll be it. Then I'll shut up. At the Scottish Huntington's Association meeting, I saw a wonderful young woman named Sarah Winkless speak. Some people will know Sarah. She's from the UK. She is an Olympic gold bronze medalist, I think, in the two women's rowing thing of the previous Olympics.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And she is a dynamic speaker. And in Scotland, they had her. She's the patron of the Scottish Hunting Association. But she talked about drawing on her athletic about being an athlete, that an athlete at her level doesn't hope to win medals. They intend to win medals. And they make that distinction because they need to set the goal, and when you go from hoping for something to intending to, that it makes you say, okay, well, how am I going to achieve this? And when I started to think of it, as she laid out the analogy in the quest to do something about Huntington's disease, or the project, for those of you in business, it's really a project we're managing here, to do something about Huntington's disease. We don't hope for a cure. We intend to cure or get a therapy, whatever. And once we get that attitude of intent, it allows you to say, okay, what's my role, and to break down the more active things. So I learned from her not to think any more about be as kind of nebulous as hope, although I know what hope is and how indispensable it is in all aspects of life, just like prayer. But when you think of the notion of we intend to do something about this, it sets up the call to everybody having to consider this if we're going to do it. So that's all I have to say. Finally.
Okay, awesome. We had a comment from Judy Robertson. She says, perhaps have people who have been in trials on the show so people can ask them questions. And that's a great idea. I got sold on the ACR 16 trial by listening to 5 people who were in that trial speak at 2009 Huntington's study group meeting and got 2 people to sign up. So that's a great idea.
That is an awesome idea.
I think we should do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, next show idea, guys. Well, listen to me again. Thank you so much. And I love what you said about Sarah Winkless. And, you know, it's good stuff. Announcements. Let me go into that, and then we'll wrap up the show. And unless there's any other comments or questions from the listeners out there, January 16, we have, speaking of clinical studies, Cresty will have an update with Karen and Bonnie. January 21st, we have Dr. Ben Deverman. He's from Caltech. January 22nd, Gene Veritas, a.k.a. Ken Serban, will be on with a special presentation about World Stem Cell Summit. And January 25, we'll have another amazing English-Spanish program with Daniel Medina and Brenda Vega. So stay tuned and come back and listen to the recorded episodes. Tell all your friends and family, of course, about Help for HD Radio. Get the free app, Help for HD, the original mobile connection to education, resources, and information about JHD and HD. And find us on Facebook. And, Jimmy, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Love
having you on the show. And we'll talk soon. Everybody have a great night. Take care.
You got a good night, everybody. Thanks again. Bye.
And talk to you tomorrow, actually. Bye.